soldiers who have been martyred in the 2 years of Israeli aggression against Muslim nations. In Sana'a, protesters commemorated Major General Mohammed Al-Ghamadi, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike last month.
We came out to say that we are sacrificing our leaders for martyrdom in the path of Allah. The blood of these martyrs paves the way for victory for the Islamic world. It has already granted victory and honor to the Palestinians and lifted the siege against Gaza.
Protesters also praised the Palestinian people for achieving a historic victory against the Israeli regime. In 2 years of Palestinian resistance, many leaders fell, including Yahya Sinwar, who was martyred while fighting until his very last breath.
We are here to congratulate the Palestinians on their victory and to praise their patience and steadfastness. You have proven to the world that you will never forsake your land and your cause. We will remain with you all the way.
For Yemenis, many more battles are still ahead, and Yemen will be prepared for another round against Israel.
Our motto is, if they resume their attacks, we will return with our punishments. We tell our brothers in Gaza and our brothers across the world that we will continue with our fight against tyranny and oppression, and we will remain on this path to sacrifice our blood for the sake of Allah.
As Israel continues its war crimes across West Asia, Yemenis say Israel will pay a heavy price sooner or later. But how does Yemen plan on making Israel pay? Yemeni military officials have hinted at the revelation of new precision missiles that Israeli anti-missile systems will have no answer for.
Yemenis here believe that the country's armed forces could continue to develop and manufacture precision missiles, which they believe should be used to deter the Israeli regime from continuing its acts of aggression against the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Inside Wormwood Scrubs, Muhammad Omar Khalid is facing what supporters describe as religious persecution and state retaliation for his political beliefs. The 22-year-old was arrested on the 1st of August and has since been held without trial after being accused of taking part in direct action against Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons producer. His protest targeted the UK's ongoing military ties to Israel, which, in addition to supplying weapons, has also collected surveillance intelligence over Gaza at the expense of the UK taxpayer.
Being a former political prisoner, I understand the repression that comes inside prison and how political prisoners are specifically targeted. There's an extra layer to this, of course, since the prescription of Palestine Action. This has brought a whole new level of repression and violence against political prisoners.
While in custody, Ahmed reports that he has been harassed by prison officers for performing the Adhan, the Muslim call to prayer. On October 7th, after refusing to stop his recitation, officers allegedly placed him in a chokehold, stripped him by force, and left him bruised and injured, all without medical care.
Despite being beaten and forcibly strip searched, Omar says in his statement that he knows that he could do more for Palestine and that he has never tasted freedom until now.
British media and politicians have been accused of interfering in the administration of justice by publicly commenting on the Filton 24 case, which has impacted their treatment while in remand.
They have been treated and labelled as high-risk prisoners. They have been called terrorists from the staff from inside the prison. And they've not allowed or enabled services to other prisoners across the network.
The assault, coupled with his placement in solitary confinement, has sparked outrage amongst human rights observers and faith communities.
It's our duty to come here to support him, because the way that they treated him, the way that they oppressed him, in the way that they persecuted him, is not tolerated in any way, shape or form. And what we need to do is to stand firm with him, because just as they try to lower his honour, he'll be also elevated, just like the prisoners in Palestine.
It appears that Britain's so-called counter-terror framework has crossed the line into criminalizing conscience, faith, and the right to resist war. Latifa Bushara, London.
President Donald Trump once again suggested South Korea had agreed on an upfront investment of $350 billion in U.S. industries to be dispersed as Trump administration officials directed. Upon learning again of Trump's claim, civil society leaders brought their objections outside the U.S. Embassy in Seoul.
South Koreans' taxes and industries are being sacrificed for American interests. Yet the Trump administration constantly accuses South Korea of free-riding on the United States, while in reality, it's the U.S. that has been free-riding on South Korea.
Some South Koreans view Trump's upfront demand as part of a tactical ploy. Others suggest the strategy may backfire and that countries facing Trump's extortion work together.
I don't think it's a fair negotiation, realistically, because it seems like an impossible amount. I think President Trump made a somewhat unreasonable proposal to gain a bit of an advantage in the tariff negotiations.
Trump's trade and tariff policies have a high possibility of isolating the United States. I think other countries in the international community should cooperate to address the unfairness of Trump's policies.
The recent expulsion of South Korean workers from a South Korean factory in the U.S. state of Georgia has turned public opinion here against Washington. South Korea has spent decades developing a core industrial base in steel, automobiles, shipbuilding, and electronics, focused on exports. Economists here warn that shifting hundreds of billions of dollars to the U.S. would threaten that base, transfer tens of thousands of jobs out of the country, and imperil the entire South Korean economy. U.S. officials this week said trade negotiations with South Korea are about to finish up. An agreement between Trump and South Korean President Lee Jae-myung may emerge at South Korea's hosting of the APEC summit later this month. Frank Smith, Seoul.
During a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin, Syria's self-proclaimed president and the leader of the transitional government, Ahmed al-Shara, assured that Damascus intends to take steps on resuming comprehensive cooperation with the Russian Federation. He emphasized the critical importance of maintaining stability in the region. Referring to bilateral ties, he said Moscow should see it through a new Syria. The Russian leader, for his part, noted that special relations between Damascus and Moscow developed decades ago. President Putin emphasized that Syria and Russia have a unique relationship that has grown over the course of 80 years, having been formed in the midst of Russia's and the Soviet Union's most trying circumstances in late 1944. Throughout the decades, the two have maintained a close relationship. He also expressed hope that the recent parliamentary elections in Syria will lead to the consolidation of society and will contribute to the further strengthening of ties between the country's political forces. Experts believe that Russia and Syria have many joint initiatives that Moscow is ready to develop.
Jilani's assertion that the new Syria abides by all early agreements struck between Moscow and Damascus encapsulates the conclusion of this discussion in the Kremlin. Russia still has two military bases, large investments in Syria, and other intentions, the execution of which is still uncertain. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Despite the ceasefire agreement reached between Hamas and Israel last week, the regime's forces have killed more Palestinians and imposed new restrictions on humanitarian aid entering Gaza. The Rafah crossing, a critical lifeline for supplies and medical evacuations, remains closed, contrary to earlier commitments. Aid deliveries have also slowed dramatically. Truck drivers report long delays and extensive inspections. According to the United Nations, Israel is allowing only 300 aid trucks into Gaza daily. That's half the amount agreed upon. The UN has urged all parties to uphold their commitments and facilitate humanitarian access.
We certainly want as much aid as possible to go in. And like I said, we're asking all of the parties to adhere to their agreements.
Under the deal, Hamas agreed to release all remaining Israeli captives, both living and deceased, in exchange for the release of approximately 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. While Israeli officials accuse Hamas of violating the agreement over the return of captives' bodies, the group insists it has fulfilled its obligations, citing the need for special equipment to retrieve bodies buried under the rubble. Even U.S. President Donald Trump, Israel's closest ally, has downplayed the claim, describing the search for the remains of Israeli captives in Gaza as a gruesome process.
So we have the living hostages all back. They returned some more today. It's a gruesome process. I almost hate to talk about it. But they're digging. They're actually digging. There are areas where they're digging and they're finding a lot of bodies.
This says Israel has yet to approve the entry of heavy machinery needed for removing 70 million tons of rubble from the war, further complicating recovery efforts. Beyond Gaza, Israeli forces and settlers still raid areas across the occupied West Bank, including attacks on olive harvesters and farmland. In Lebanon, ceasefire violations persist, with Israeli strikes targeting southern regions. As the Israeli regime appears to be falling short of its obligations in the region, the future of the Gaza ceasefire remains precarious. Observers warn that without accountability and full access for aid agencies, the truce faces a serious risk.
At the University of Paris 8 in Saint-Denis, teachers, students, and activists gathered for a roundtable titled, After 2 Years of Genocide, What Future Remains for Palestinians? The organizers called for continued political and grassroots mobilization until colonization ends. The conference, organized by Révolution Permanente Euro-Palestine and the Student Union Federation, featured speakers from various backgrounds, some of whom recently returned flotilla, which was intercepted by occupation forces. They all agreed that the humanitarian situation remains catastrophic and that the political struggle must continue. Speakers and attendees stressed the need for continued engagement, both within imperialist countries that support the occupation and across the Arab world, where governments are accused of relaying colonial policies. Many also spoke about the repression faced by activists on the ground and at sea. The Paris 8 roundtable ended with a unified message. Do not settle for fragile agreements or temporary promises. Continue political, legal, and popular mobilization until colonization ends. For the organizers, Révolution Permanente, Euro-Palestine, and the Student Union Federation, the goal is clear: to strengthen international solidarity and intensify actions to achieve the liberation of the Palestinian people and the restoration of their fundamental rights. Kasim Hassan, Paris.
Palestinian prisoner Saeed Toubassi from Jenin refugee camp has spent over 20 years behind bars, serving 31 life sentences and 50 additional years. His family had long-awaited his release, hoping the current ceasefire deal would finally bring him home. Instead, his mother was left devastated after learning that his name was not included.
I really thought this time he would come home. I had so much hope. We all did. We were ready to welcome him after so many years. Saeed was imprisoned when he was just a young man, and now most of his life has passed behind bars. He is ill and needs medical treatment. I just want to see him free before I die.
Yaqub al-Qadri, sentenced to 2 life terms and 35 years in jail, is one of the 6 Palestinian prisoners who escaped through the Freedom Tunnel from Jalbur prison in 2021. He was recaptured days later, with his story being a symbol of resistance and endurance. His family, who have already lost their parents, had hoped this deal would reunite them, but the news brought only renewed heartbreak.
We stayed up all night, hoping his name would be on the list. We had so much hope, because he was one of the heroes of the Freedom Tunnel operation. All the others were freed, and we believed he would be too. But he stayed behind. His health is fragile. He suffers from thyroid cancer and multiple bone fractures, and he has been in prison since 2021. It's heartbreaking to know he's still locked in his cell while we wait for justice.
For others, the pain is even much higher, as the name of their loved one was in the list, but removed later.
We came back from abroad to welcome my brother. We had prepared a present for his release and were full of hope, as his name was in the list. But when the final decision came, he was not released. the deployment was heartbreaking. We had imagined this moment for so long, but it didn't come.
Mohammed Sabah is serving 23 years in Israeli prison. He is among thousands who are waiting for their freedom from Israeli jail notorious for mistreatment of inmates.
In the occupied Palestinian territories, joy never overcomes the pain, especially for the families of those who have been held illegally by the Israeli regime. They waited with hope to see their loved ones walk free. But once again, the occupying regime turned their happiness into heartbreak. Tibasi, occupied Jenin.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans of the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on September 20th, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. Is it a small achievement to build a bridge over the turbulent, wild Arvand Rud border river between Iran and Iraq, and to have several armies across while being bombarded by the enemy? Was that even possible? The enemy couldn't believe such a thing could happen, but it did. That was a capacity. It was a talent. It was hidden, but it became apparent. This is one of the important achievements. By referring to the work that our youth carried out in those days during the Sacred Defense, we can now confidently say that our youth can solve all of the country's problems today. When it is said, in changes of circumstances, the essences of humans become known, Nahjul Balagha, Wisdom 217, it is not just about people, it is about societies as well. You can see the true colors of a society in difficult, problematic events. We did not know ourselves, and neither did other people. The world did not know us either. During the Sacred Defense, we learned about ourselves, and others learned about us too. Those who were making so many false claims in the world realized who we are. Another achievement of the Sacred Defense was safeguarding the country. It safeguarded the country. In other words, the Sacred Defense safeguarded the country against possible military attacks to a large extent. They kept saying that military action is also on the table, but it did not even budge from the table, because they knew that if they were to enter this field, they may be able to initiate it, but they will not be the ones to finish it. This was what the Sacred Defense demonstrated. This is another achievement. Deep, sincere faith, strong, firm determination, the intelligence of the Iranian youth, the ability of military and non-military elements to use initiative and innovation, and the ability to overcome global aggressors were the things that were revealed and seen about our nation and our soldiers during the Sacred Defense. Well, the nation itself recognized these things. Naturally, when we recognize and understand that we have these abilities, our hope will increase, our vitality will increase, and we will try to use these capabilities even more.
Tensions between Caracas and Washington show no sign of abating. U.S. military has carried out its latest strike on another Venezuelan boat claiming that it was smuggling drugs. This came a day after U.S. President Donald Trump confirmed that he had authorized the CIA to carry out covert operations in Venezuela and suggested that he was even mulling a land attack as well. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro condemned Washington's actions, warning the U.S. against any further escalation. He said the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency had conspired not only against him, but also against former President Hugo Chavez. That and more on this edition of Spotlight. Here are our guests for tonight's show. Academic and political analyst Bruno Beclini is joining us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. And we also have journalist and political commentator Seif Mohsen Abbas, who's with us from the British capital. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Beclini in Porto Alegre. Donald Trump is cranking up pressure against Venezuela. How would you describe the situation with Venezuela right now, especially with this heavy U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean?
Well, thanks for having me. Talking to many contacts and friends and colleagues from Venezuela, they are telling me that the kind of new wave of inflation is corrosion is attacking the capacity of the salaries inside of Venezuela. Besides this, the government, the administration still have a lot of support. The whole full country is in full mobilization. And as said Maduro, CIA threatens Latin America republics and administration since day one of the agency. So this is nothing new. What is new, and I would like to put this on debate, is the early retirement of Admiral Fauci, which was the first man in Southwest Command in 4th Fleet, because he is against, even him, he is against the militarization of the Caribbean. So I would say the state of Venezuela is in full mobilization, society is together against the imperialism threat, and maybe they will try a regime change with a terrorist attack or something like this.
Mohsen Abbas, this is the biggest U.S. naval mobilization on Latin America since Panama back in 1989. Theories are flying, as experts say, this force is far too big for combating drug trafficking. Others believe it's not big enough for a full invasion. What is the overall purpose of this operation, in your opinion?
Well, they're certainly threatening Venezuela, and they're threatening President Maduro for the crime of trying to keep Venezuela an independent sovereign nation and the freedom of these sorts of nations that don't want to bend the knee to imperialism of the US and Zionism, I have to say, is a crime which is punishable by war and missiles and bombs. You only need to look at West Asia for exactly what that is all about. And a lot of what happens in Venezuela parallels what's going on against Iran. The policies of, for instance, you know, economic sanctions, you know, basically financial blockades, sweeping embargo, which they imposed in 2019, you know, collective punishment of an entire population just because the Americans can't get hold of the oil. That's what they want. They want Venezuelan oil and resources. And because they can't get their hands on it, they've frozen Venezuela's billions in gold across the world, and you know, in the markets, and they've also scared away investors. And then, of course, when the economic hardships kick in nations after all this economic terrorism, they blame the President Maduro. Exactly what they're trying to do with the Islamic Republic of Iran. But of course, this doesn't wash. They're also not ashamed or embarrassed by this anymore. The Americans are making it very clear they want to be an open imperialist force, and Venezuela has been basically part, well, it's in the crosshairs on a direct level. 10,000 U.S. troops have been deployed in Latin America this year, and Trump has been building up this military set of assets in the region, including 8 Navy ships, F-35 fighter jets, MQ-9 Reaper drones, and of course now B-52 bombers. I mean, why would you use B-52 bombers for drugs traders, you know, drugs villains? If it was really drugs, why do they need nuclear bomb carrying B-52 bombers. That just tells you this is nothing to do with the drugs business, because actually the CIA is the major drug dealer in the world, as we know from their time in Afghanistan and the drugs that went up exponentially during the US occupation, as we know from the US deep state's own records of flooding their black American communities with drugs on the streets. These are all facts that which are there for those who want to dig them, and they're on record. You know, drugs is part of the American and the industrial military mafia's business. They're the ones who profit. And the other thing that has to destroy the arguments of Trump about it being some sort of war on drugs is, of course, that most of the drugs going through the U.S., if you trace them carefully, they come through Mexico or they come through the sea routes in the Pacific. It's not through the Caribbean Sea. Drugs across the Caribbean Sea, the experts say, end up in Europe. But so to blame Venezuela for drugs that are landing in America is palpably false. So this is a regime change. This is stirring up the waters and preparing the ground to try and create some kind of a change of government, which they've been trying to do, of course, for decades now.
On that note that you just mentioned, Mr. Abbas, I want to address this next question to Mr. Beclini. Venezuelan government officials have reportedly cited UN reports which show that traffickers move only 5% of the cocaine produced in Colombia through Venezuela. The latest UN World Drug Report also does not assign Venezuela the major role that Washington has in recent months. There's some serious inconsistencies with what Washington is claiming here.
I must say something very rude. I apologize for your audience. 87% of the drug dealing through maritime ocean goes through the Pacific. The biggest company accused of being inside of the narco dealing is the Noboa Trading, which belongs to the president of Ecuador, Daniel Noboa, which is an ally of the United States. Marco Rubio, once in Ecuador, he said, and I'm quoting, "I don't care about what the United Nations is saying on Daniel Noboa. I don't care about the Office on Drugs of the United Nations. We have our own numbers. We have our own truth." So they don't care about the truth, which is the big ally of the United States to the full 21st century in Latin America. Alvaro Uribe Vélez, who is this man? He's one of the founders of the Cartel de Medellín cartel, one of the founders. Another situation, they are sponsoring Javier Milei in Argentina. Javier Milei was a consultant to a narco dealer, Fred Machado, who has a requirement of being extradited to go in jail in Texas, United States. Another reason for their lying, they are sponsoring President Peña in Paraguay. President Peña is the former president of Banco Amambay, Bassa Bank. The Bassa Bank is sanctioned by the Treasury Office because of this. This is a laundry for money from drug dealing. So they are hypocrites. This is full hypocrites. Full hypocrisy.
Okay, so Mohsen Abbas, President Donald Trump confirmed that he's authorized the CIA to carry out covert operations in Venezuela. The Venezuelan foreign minister made a statement that the involvement of the CIA as well as U.S. military deployment in the Caribbean are part of a broader strategy to legitimize regime change, ultimately targeting Venezuela's vast oil reserves. That's also something you alluded to as well. Can you break down those recent comments coming from the U.S. president with regards to CIA's covert operations in Venezuela?
You know, there was a time when whatever the CIA did was denied by the U.S. government. That's when the days of actually having some sort of common sense way of dealing with. They were just as devious and just as cunning and just as violent in their coups. Let's just take, for example, Guatemala in 54 and Chile in 1973. The US has a clear track record, but they used to try and hide it. It used to be years later before you could find absolute evidence. Now they don't even try to hide it. What Trump does, he tells people straightforward what he's going to do, which is just, again, reiterating the fact that they're deploying sort of gunboat diplomacy, outright imperialist boot stamping, and they really don't care what the world thinks, and the image of America doesn't matter to them. All that matters is the oil and the resources. Now, in terms of covert operations and the threat, well, you know, of course, we know for a fact that Trump has not just said it now. He's been saying it for several months before. And they've not just, with the Guaido situation, you remember how, for instance, they supported openly a coup. They were literally supporting a separate president, somebody who, a self-declared president, even though he'd lost the election, Guaido, against Maduro, he called himself president, and the Americans were the first to recognize it. So literally, they were openly financing, supporting, and legitimizing a kind of a breakdown in Venezuelan democracy. So it is today. You know who's won the Nobel Prize, don't you? You know, Donald Trump was so generous, he didn't bother really pushing for the Nobel Prize because he wanted his dear sweetheart, Maria Corina Machado, you know, the so-called outspoken critic of the Venezuelan government. And evidently she got this Nobel Prize because she's so brave, she's so, you know, valiant in her efforts to denounce a government which is trying to basically cater for the independence of her people, while she openly advocates a love of Trump, a love of neoliberalism, a love of American transnational corporations, which she's begging to come into Venezuela and to occupy it and asset strip the whole country, to rip them off. So, you know, nowadays what we're getting is open coup support for coup d'etat. There's nothing hidden about this. And I think it's obviously something that the world has to look at. I mean, the Venezuelans have said, look, the UN needs to call it out. Why is the UN standing by without any word on this issue, given that yet another sovereign nation is being threatened in terms of its independence with violence by America? We have to ask the question, where are the international so-called communities and the international bodies on all this? Is there no rule of law left? Is there no international justice? Seems like it. And Venezuela looks like it's just another victim of exactly that. Will they try to assassinate Maduro? Will they try to go on the ground and whip up sort of insurgencies, or pay off and buy off people who want to basically act as mercenaries in the country? Well, that's all to be seen, and okay. The Venezuelans are prepared.
Mr. Bickling, I saw you nodding there. Of course, in that regard, Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, has denounced the U.S. president's remarks about the CIA covert operations. He says they reflect the pattern of unsuccessful U.S. military interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. Historically, we know the U.S. has always had a meddlesome hand in Latin America. It's been on a quest to weaken leftist governments in that region. Help us better understand what it is that Washington is worried about.
Let's understand something. 2 days ago, Maria Corina Machado gave an interview to U.S. mainstream media, and she committed herself, once in power, to privatize the Venezuela Petroleum Company, PDVSA. She also committed herself to open all internal markets for U.S. companies, including technology, minerals, agriculture, water resources. I think that what's going on in Washington now is against their own interests, because they not renewed the license for Chevron to operate inside of Venezuela. What is the result? The result is full commitment of Russian oil companies inside of Venezuela, and more interchange between Venezuela and Iran, Venezuela and China, Venezuela and Russia. They are very afraid to have a powerful and rich country like Venezuela to have an example of development without being a neo-colony of the United States. I think that this is what they are very afraid about.
Okay, and Mr. Abbas, what about the global reactions to these tensions? Iran, Russia, China, they voiced their support for Venezuela amid Washington's actions, these military threats. Even Brazil has warned U.S. meddling could destabilize the region.
Because Russia has faced this kind of meddling already, it's still facing it in the war in Ukraine and beyond, because Iran has faced it. They've suffered the 12-day violation of their own country by Israel, backed by America, again, to achieve what? Regime change. That's exactly the same playbook. So what the world needs to do is take note that the U.S. is now no longer hiding its intentions to put an iron grip using the industrial military complex in order to put the boot on the neck of any government in the world that wants to establish independence. And they're not doing it just for themselves, because don't forget, the US military boot on the neck of the global south or beyond is actually serving primarily the interests of the moneylender mafia. Behind them, there's an entire syndicate which bankrolls all of this itself. The debt of the Americans is in the hands of those same people. So somebody somewhere has decided that not one nation that decides to stand up as a sovereign entity should be left alone. You know, even the Chinese are under pressure, although, of course, taking on the Chinese is a different matter altogether for Trump and co. And therefore, what needs to happen is all of the global south needs to take it far more seriously. It's not enough that BRICS, whatever BRICS is doing, I believe it's not enough that the Shanghai Corporation has worked in its way so far. I think things need to be accelerated with all of these alternative institutions, because America is not going to behave itself. It will not stop until it subjugates the whole world around the agenda of 2030, the agenda of techno-feudal control of the world, and it's the main agent for delivering that. I can go further, but it's not just about these nations individually, one by one. There's a bigger picture in which the U.S. military and its proxies around the world, don't forget whether it's Al-Qaeda or whether it's mercenaries in Venezuela or whether it's the people who they've got fighting for them, you know, in Ukraine, they're not sending necessarily their own military troops in most places, but they're now active with all of the proxies who they pour money into to create instability in order to regain control of the resources of the world and to make sure that they're not muscled out by the Chinese, I assume. So what we've got is a global situation within which Venezuela now is a major part. And of course, it serves as another warning for all of these nations that unless they unite to create a sort of a bulwark against the Americans, one by one, each one of them can be subjected to even more extortion, because wherever America isn't getting the pushback, they extort. They extort the money, and for instance, take Saudi Arabia, for example, $3 trillion of its money, of its oil wealth, is in real estate in America, probably more, because that's the price you have to pay in order for not to have a regime change in the global south. Unless the global south forms really solid pushback and international and stops relying on the likes of the UN, because the UN is a defunct organization, the WHO, the AIEA, all the institutions created after 1945 serve the interests of the Americans, and actually none of them are any good for peace and unity around the world, or harmony, or all serving American imperialism.
Mr. Biclini, the U.S. military, it has reportedly struck another vessel in the Caribbean. This, of course, took place, I think, a couple of days ago. There's been at least six incidents of U.S. strikes on boats in Venezuelan waters since the beginning of September, claiming that the boats were carrying illegal narcotics. There's so many questions here. One of the main ones being, what are the rules of engagement for carrying out strikes around Venezuela and with regards to the legality of Washington's attack? So here's where it gets interesting. Following the recent strike, the admiral who is overseeing the Trump administration's military campaign, he announced an early resignation, which actually further raises questions about the legality and the human cost of these operations.
I think we do have a kind of good news. Admiral Holsey, retiring 3 years before his mandate of Southern Command, implicates the visible part of an iceberg between a struggle inside of U.S. deep state between Pete Hegseth, which is a mercenary, former special forces, against the generals, admirers, and brigadiers of U.S. Marine Corps, Air Force, Army, and Navy. I think that U.S. deep state will go in certain manner against those mercs and those businessmen. Besides Marco Rubio, which is a gusano, a man who comes from his political base, is the Cuban exile, ultra-right-wing mafia, like Alpha 66, and all of those bad guys around Donald Trump. They claim that they are fighting against narcotics in the Caribbean. They are lying. The only boat of narcotics that I took notice was apprehended and put in jail about 3 weeks ago was a DEA boat, which was apprehended by Bolivarian Republic of Venezuelan troops, their national police. And the dealer revealed This was a false flag operation to install inside of Venezuela about more than 1 ton of cocaine. So they are liars, and they are fighting against themselves inside of U.S. deep state right now.
Simple as that, boss. Coup attempts, threats of military intervention, self-appointed presidents. The attitude and stance, it hasn't changed regarding Venezuela over different U.S. administrations. In your opinion, what is the end game for the U.S. when it comes to Venezuela?
They want to get rid of the socialist government. They want to impose their own neoliberal puppet in Venezuela. They want to have full access to Venezuelan oil. They want to be able to crush any kind of people's movement. Ultimately, they would basically back the veneer of some kind of Western-style democracy. But we all know what Western democracy is down in Israel. Don't just go and have a little look at what American democracy looks like in Gaza these days, and you'll know. Look at it in Libya. Go and check it out in Syria. Check it out in Afghanistan, wherever they try to implement their so-called democracy. We've seen the results. The same results would occur in Venezuela. The rich would get richer, the poor would get poorer, and the only reason that they've got this opportunity to even have any kind of argument against the Maduro government and its own, of course, weaknesses would be that they basically, you know, the economic crisis that exists there is down to the U.S. policies. They, you know, given severe comprehensive sanctions imposed since 2017, and they've significantly exacerbated the crisis within the country. With these kinds of developing countries, there are always problems. But if you get an outside force making even more problems, cutting off your lifeline, cutting off your only source of real income. I mean, in Venezuela, if it sold its oil around the world and it was free to do so, it would be extremely wealthy and there wouldn't be any problem. But the Americans have sanctioned them. Any company that tries to engage with Venezuela is hit. They can't even get refineries. Of course, it's sophisticated to have refineries. Venezuelans don't have access to being able to refine their oil. So even their crude, of course, is now suffering. And, of course, the humanitarian suffering that goes with the poverty and the instability that the Americans have created, that becomes another way of trying to trigger the coup. And that's what they've been doing, to try and create unrest within Venezuelan people because of economic hardships. But you can't recover with the kind of stranglehold that the Americans have put on them. So I think the end game is all about regime change. They want to basically isolate Venezuela internationally. They want to fuel a protracted political standoff. They want to ideally now even perhaps send in their own insurgents and their own coup d'etat villains, which is tempting Donald Trump. Whether he'll do it or not, one doesn't know, but he's certainly banging the drums.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to have to leave it there. Academic and political analyst Bruno Biclini, joining us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. And thanks to Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com www.iwr.org/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina